Hi, I'm Emma Cousin, an artist in Southeast London, and I started this podcast to keep us artists in touch under lockdown and now as we come out of it. I wanted to talk to other artists about the impact on the artistic community and explore what's changed, what's lost, and what's been discovered. In this episode, Tom James and I talk about being exhausted, kids, childcare, carving out 10-minute art time, chores, wiping, and beard growing. Tom tells us about his forthcoming project, Absolute Beginners, a proposal to create a new factory where young people can learn to make basic goods in an off-grid, future-proof way. We talk about planning for when the economy collapses, about being half sad and half funny, and about getting the tone right. We talk about having alternative ideas of how to live from within the world of cling film. We talk about the future manual, being hopeful and hopeless, infiltrating the art world, and creating a vehicle for writing. We talk about starting fires and catching rabbits. We discuss the future, how far away it is, and what it might feel like, and the need to learn something physical, opening up a real space to talk about how it feels to make things. We talk about the joy of eating with loved ones, together, and learning how beautiful London could be. Thank you for joining us for Chats with Artists Under Lockdown. Hello, Tom James.
Hello, Emma. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. I'm all right. I am feeling, sleepier. I've calmed down energy-wise, which is helpful. How are you feeling?
How am I feeling? I'm feeling exhausted.
Oh.
But yeah, I actually feel quite nice today, exhausted in general. So today I am in my studio for the first time since lockdown started, which is a really strange thing because it is normal. It's normal life here. Mm. But for the last 2.5 months, I have been in my flat with my partner and my two daughters, and that has been quite intense.
Yeah, very. And is that something, how much time, like what's the difference shift in that in terms of how much time you would normally have in the studio?
Well, I mean, I've been, so my daughter, my oldest daughter is 3.5 now-ish, sort of a third. And my youngest daughter is 4 months old, so she's new.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you very much. She's actually really cute. She's so sicky. She's like the pukiest, cutest in the world. But until my partner's been on maternity leave again, I was doing sort of about 2 days a week childcare with Joni, who's my oldest. And so I'd normally get into the studio like 2 days a week anyway. So it doesn't feel that different not being in the studio. Mm. But what is really different is having children around the whole time, because obviously childcare has stopped. Yeah. And I think trying to keep some sort of regularity and trying to keep some sort of rhythm and productivity whilst also trying to make sure your children aren't bored witless. it's really hard, and it's not something that we should have to do. You know, I've seen a lot of people saying this thing about, you know, you're not just working from home, you're working at home in a pandemic with your children there. Mm. And you shouldn't be expected to be doing as much as you normally can, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's very true. And how is that possible? Like, are you what is possible in those conditions, I suppose?
So it's really difficult. Like, I think, in a way, we've been fortunate because it's been so hot. And so my partner has sort of a few days a week taken both of them out for half a day. But really, because my daughter's so young, like, you know, the baby, I haven't really felt like I can just come to the studio for a day. You know, my studio mates have been doing that because they've got different age children. But my partner's needed a lot of help. And so, like, So we're in this weird situation where you are just trying to carve out time to do art, right? And like doing art in 10 minutes or doing art in 15 minutes. And of course, as everyone who else who does art and everyone who's listening to this knows, you know, like you're not actually doing art, you're doing emails and you're doing and you're doing websites and blah, 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 blah. But even doing that in sort of like half hour blocks is pretty exhausting.
Yeah, that's true. I love that idea. Doing art in 10 minutes. That could be the next podcast. Oh.
Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here, yeah. Love it.
Sorry. So I'm tired, basically, but it's okay.
Tired, yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, it's interesting that you're, because four months old is still little as well, so she might not be sleeping and stuff as well. So there's also sleeplessness.
It's just like, I think it's just the amount of work, you know, it's the amount of chores, the amount of wiping and changing and cooking and cleaning. I've become a part-time domestic servant to myself, unpaid, and that's weird, right? That's a weird choice to make for a human being.
Yeah.
But
like you say, it's not fully a choice, although you are sporting an amazing beard.
Thank you very much. Yeah, well, so that's the other side of lockdown is that I have let my beard grow for the first time in my life, because I now can, because I'm 37. And I've still got these sort of prepubescent patches on my face that don't grow any hair. So my friends often tell me I look like a French policeman when I let my moustache grow. But yeah, for the first time ever, I've got this amazing beard on the bottom as well. So it's sort of like this, it's just like a fun thing. It's really fun to be a male human being and have hair coming out your face. It's really weird. So I think that's been quite a good side of lockdown.
Yeah, what do your kids think of it?
Joni announced the other day that I'm allowed to keep it if I want to.
Oh.
I was like, what do you think of the beard? She was like, I don't like it, Daddy. And then she's like, you keep it if you want to keep it, Daddy. So, you know, that's very nice of her, isn't it? Really?
Kind. Amazing. So have you been able to make things in this domestic arena, like with the 10-minute art? Have the things that have come out of that limitation, or is it more of a frustration and a stopping altogether?
It's a funny thing, because so at the moment I'm working on a new project which is called Absolute Beginners, and basically it's going to be a factory where young people can learn how to make the basic goods which we'll need in the collapsing economies of our future. And it's on this industrial estate called Park Royal in West London. So basically it's sort of learning to make the things that used to be produced on the estate, but which are now produced far away, but learning to make them in a really sustainable way, in a sort of using locally sourced materials and local tools, and to make them in the way that we might have to make them when our economy starts to collapse, basically, which, as you know, is a big theme of my work. But so that project has been going, sort of been in the planning stages since last November, and it's still hopefully going to happen this year. Like, it's one of these things that is suddenly sort of, it's all delayed, and it's all contingent on when things get back to normal in some way.
Yeah.
So I've been basically beavering away doing all this behind the scenes planning stuff, and like the commissioning my friend John Cannon, who's a great designer, to do the design, and trying to sort out the messaging, and trying to get the youth, to recruit the youth and get all the flyers ready and all this sort of stuff. But it's that weird thing, being busy and being not busy at the same time, because you're trying to be productive, you're trying to make as much use as you can of the time without knowing when that time is going to end at all, So
I'm
sure that's something.
Well, it's also that idea of coming out of the lockdown, isn't it? So it's sort of like, at what point, what does that look like, and how is that affecting, nothing's really changed, but somehow things are shifting, aren't they, as well?
Yeah, completely. Like, what will normal be? And so, like, a big part of the project was going to be working with old makers to talk about what they used to make before it obviously all went off to the other side of the world, where we get people to do our dirty work for us. But those old makers, I can't really talk to them in the same way now. We can't get them in the room and have tea and cake.
Yeah.
It's risky.
Well, yeah, like
it's life-threatening. And so I think suddenly it's just a very strange thing that's happening to all of us, isn't it, really?
Yeah, but I think it's really interesting as well to think about. I mean, obviously, without being too, we don't know what's going to happen, but the idea of the economy being pretty precarious at the moment, given the sort of the brakes on everything, and we don't really know what that's going to look like, and lots of people have been furloughed, and we don't know what the implications of these things are going to be in terms of that either, thinking about when the economy collapses, it suddenly feels that little bit more fragile than it was probably in January as well. So this feels like even more, I don't know, potent. Has it taken on more kind of urgency, or has it changed given that, or is it, or did you always, I mean, how has that affected the project?
Yeah, that's really interesting question. I think that you need to be really, suddenly I need to be careful about the tone in a different way, because a lot of my work over the last 4 years, I've been really interested in it being half funny, half sad, and half satirical and serious, you know, and because it is like talking about climate change and what we are collectively doing to the planet is funny. You have to see it as this sort of cosmic sitcom. Like it's like the story, it's like the story of the dodo, right?
Yeah.
Writ large. Like, yeah. if you were watching this as an alien, you'd be like, it's hilarious. Yeah. Nespresso machines are hilarious. Like it is. But then, so like a lot of my work has been this sort of semi-satirical thing. But then when actually suddenly it's the collapse is not just Brexit and not just climate change and not Big Sainsbury's on fire in some uncertain future, but actually now around you. And I think that the tone, I just need to be a bit more careful now of the tone I'm using, if that makes sense.
Definitely. And I think it also takes on, in terms of like satire, it takes on a sort of capacity of like, not quite melancholy, but something about like the potential of being haunted by futures that could have happened.
Yeah, yeah,
Does that make sense? Like ghosts of futures.
Yeah, totally. I think that's really interesting. And I think the more I read about climate change, and the more I read, you know, I think because I've been wanting to write to do art or do something about climate change for about a decade, but never really knew what form I should take and how to solve that issue of tone, and whether it should be a campaign about wind turbines or whether it should be going and living in the woods as a prepper, you know.
Yeah.
And getting the tone right has been a real challenge. But I think the more I read about it, and the more I read about how much it's locked in and how it doesn't really matter what we do now, we're going to get this sort of certain amount of, you know, 1.5 degrees of warming or 2 degrees of warming, and what that will mean for my children's generation. It is very melancholy, very sad thing, very sort of sorrowful and sad. But then at the same time, I the more time I spend doing projects like The Clearing and like The Future Manual and hopefully like Absolute Beginners, I think the key thing about them has been bringing people together, real people, to learn real things. And when you do that, when you have real people in the room learning how to make mead or how to look after chickens or how to make a wind turbine or whatever, like the fact of human beings being in this place and helping each other learn and actually learning something physical with their hands and you know, talking about the issues and talking about the wider issues that we're the wider mess we're making. There's something really positive about it and really hopeful about it.
I think it's also something that's at, like, in terms of agency, you're actually doing, like, there's a lot about discussions and meetings, and you know, it's that thing of just do, right? That feels really vital as well. Like, you know, even if it's like five kids and you in a field, that you're doing something that's active, right? So I just wondered about where, because I'm really fascinated in, I don't know about you, I've been having like kind of flashbacks to childhood, and not in like a sounds really like psychological or something, but not in a traumatic way, in a way that's like, I'm reminded of stories and histories and people in my life. And a lot of that is to do with like making jam with my granddad, or like gardening with him, or learning about how to pick plums properly from a tree and what that looks like. And some of it's really simple, but a lot of it is like these things we've learned or inherited, or even about toolboxes my dad used to have in the garage, and like learning about tools and realizing I was a bit scared of tools and what's that all about. So that's quite so I guess my question is, I guess have a lot of these interests come from a childhood interest? Were you surrounded by this kind of curiosity and this doing attitude of like making and even like DIY, or you know, you're not afraid of it, basically, is what I'm saying, and you're hands on.
Yeah,
it's really important for people to get that when you run a workshop, you turn up, you have tools, you're there, you're fabricating this stuff. Like that's so where does that come from? I guess I'm asking, like, in terms of in this like, when was that? Is it like the nascency? Is that the right word? Where was it born?
I think that's really interesting because actually my childhood was extremely suburban. So like I grew up, first of all, in a Barrett house, in a Barrett estate outside York.
Me too.
That's funny. really funny. Outside York?
Well, Wakefield, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So you know what it's like. So, you know what it's like that I've got this really, really strong aversion to silent front rooms with a clock ticking on the wall and nothing happening in the street outside, you know, and I will not do that to my children.
Yeah, yeah.
My parents thought they were doing this great thing by living in this sort of detached house.
Aspirational,
exactly. And I had a really nice childhood. I had a really, you know, my parents are lovely and my grandparents are lovely, and there was nothing sort of bad about it at all, but it was so, we were so cut off from nature in that place, and we were so cut off from wildness, and we were so cut off from anything approaching hippiness, you know.
Mm.
And then we moved to West Yorkshire, to Ilkley, when I was about 11, and we were suddenly on the moor, and that was amazing. Mm. But again, we still didn't really do much in terms of sort of growing food. My granddad grew a lot of food, and my granny and granddad were sort of it's really funny, like I want to live like them. I want their house. I want their furniture, their style, their sort of the jam that my granny made, the radio, what they listened to. And obviously I'm aware that every generation does that. Every generation hates its parents' taste. and maybe my children will want to live on a Barrett estate with
I know, careful, yeah.
Labour saving devices rather than making their own jam. But I think really, so I think the key thing of where it all came from was actually realizing how ignorant and disconnected I was, you know. And I made some more hippie friends in my late childhood, and most of my friends at university aren't really hippies. I fell in with some hippies after university in Sheffield. Mm. And this amazing project called Abundance, where they harvested fruit that people didn't want and didn't need, and redistributed it to people who did need it.
I've read about that. Yeah, amazing.
Which is incredible, and pure Marxism. But I think for me, like most of the drive behind it came from the sociology lessons that I had in my sixth form, and the politics I studied, and off I went to study history and politics at university.
Mm.
And so like that. Those alternative ideas about how to live in the world and how the world could be better didn't really sort of fit with the upbringing I'd had and the suburban upbringing I'd had. So I think that it's just been trying to square that circle, really, if that makes sense. Like,
yeah,
from within consumerism, from within the world of cling film and Nespresso machines and forks that vibrate when you eat too fast and all this sort of like crap that you are faced with every day when you walk into a shop.
Yeah.
And and trying to work out how on earth to counter that and how on earth to start dismantling it in a way that doesn't just turn people off as being massively hippie, you know?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, I've got a few questions coming out of that, but the idea of like, where does art fit into that?
So I think that's the other really interesting thing for me, because so we didn't go to art galleries at all when I was a kid. I didn't know what art was, you know, like we went to country parks and we went on lots of outings, we went to museums and we had lots of fun.
Yeah.
But like, I'm not from an arty family at all. And my art education at school was non-existent. So I didn't really know what art was other than like going to the Tate Modern aged 18 and like seeing some Duchamp or something like that. And still to this day my art knowledge is very, very poor, but I think I used to call myself just a writer, and I used to do lots of work about Sheffield where I was living at the time, and lots of sort of fanzines and DIY publications and projects. I used to call them projects, really, about the cities that I was living in. But that all really sort of started to change when I did the Future Manual and a future, you know, I suppose I should explain what it is. A Future Manual,
well, I was going to say, yeah, I want to get into that. Yeah.
Well, it's like, so this was like after 5 years of trying to work out what on earth to do about climate change, and suddenly coming to this realization that I wanted to do this thing that could be useful, but also was a space to talk about how useless it felt, you know, and hopeful and hopeless at the same time, and could actually try and help people in this future that I thought might be coming, whilst also being a bit satirical. So the idea was a Future Manual, which is this DIY guide to surviving and thriving in the miserable world we're creating for our children. And each issue, like those old Learning About Dinosaurs magazines, each issue comes with teaches you one thing you'll need in this post-apocalyptic future and comes with a free gift to get you started. And so like the first one was how to build a fire, and that came with some kindling. And the second one was how to catch rabbits, and that came with some wire to make into your own snare. And then it sort of stopped because I got distracted by other projects, which we'll talk a bit about later. But what was really interesting about the future manual was, whereas the stuff, and it, I published it all myself, I printed it all myself, I, you know, stapled it together and put it in a plastic bag to keep it from getting wet in the floods and all this sort of stuff.
It's because they're kind of beautiful as well. It's worth saying they're like amazing pieces of art, right? If you want to say that. I don't know how you feel about that. But
yeah, that's kind of it. I've always really been interested in the vehicle, creating a vehicle for my writing. So I've had this really, really tough time of thinking of myself as a writer because I wasn't really a writer. I don't have books. I don't get published anywhere, really. It's always sort of self-published and wanting to create something to, you know, to have this, to say something, but also to create a way of saying it that gets to people. And suddenly, whereas the work I'd done previously in Sheffield, I could leave in cafes in Sheffield and pubs in Sheffield and people would find it. Kind of things like that sort of distribution. Suddenly, if you're doing work about the end of the world, then how do you distribute that work? How do you can't leave it in shops about the end of the world, you know? You can't. Yeah. How do you get it to people? And I was trying to use the same old techniques that I used before, like trying to put it in sort of art bookshops. And I had this really funny thing where, like, you know, this really trendy bookshop, Donlan Books on what's it called? The market in Posh London Fields.
Broadway Market. I know what you mean. Yeah.
So I took it in there. They're like, yeah, okay, we'll have it. And then they phoned me up after 6 months being like, you've got to come and get your weird book. No one wants it.
Oh, no.
But that was really interesting because I was like, you know, it looks, the way I publish it, I use all this sort of offline technology and old obsolete stuff.
Yeah.
And basically, it is identical to the artist books of the 70s that people do want because they're told that they want them because they're sexy.
Yeah, yeah.
But doing it today isn't as sexy as the sort of like artist monograph produced by the sort of small publishing house in Berlin or whatever.
Yeah.
And at the same time as that was happening, I was doing these workshops to try and find a way to distribute this idea, to get it to people. And I hit upon this idea of doing an actual workshop to teach people the skill itself.
Mm.
So I did my first one with my friend Aisha Koklu, in this amazing old factory in down near sort of Commercial Road and Whitechapel and stuff, which is incredible. And then I did the second workshop at your space at Bread and Jam in Broccoli and taught people how to catch rabbits in that space. And I think that, you know, for me, the whole thing about the Future Manual was that I taught myself it by learning it off YouTube by trial and error. And there's all these people on YouTube who are like these sort of hench guys or always men in like wraparound sunglasses and camouflage jackets talking to the GoPros about how to catch rabbits. And so the I learned myself. Grills. Sorry, go on.
I was going to say the Bear Grylls of the internet.
Exactly. You know, there's tons of those people. but they never actually teach you because you have to go away and trial and error. And find it all out for yourself, basically. And so these workshops, suddenly, you know, to do these workshops and to invite real people in to teach real people real skills in these amazing environments, in people's back gardens or in the old you know, the yards of old factories, and to sort of start fires in those places and to catch rabbits in those places. And I should say it was a fake rabbit that I caught at your house.
yeah, we should caveat that before I get those.
It was off. There's a little job. Like toy rabbit, but you know, it stands nonetheless. Like it was really interesting to me, and suddenly I was like, God, am I actually more interested in people, real people, learning this real thing with me than I am actually writing about it in these fanzines, in these manuals? And it just suddenly opened up, like. You know, I remember at one point I was sat outside the London Art Book Fair in Whitechapel Gallery.
Mm.
And because I didn't really want to get a space inside it, but nor could I really. So I set up my own little post-apocalyptic stall outside the London Art Book Fair.
Amazing.
Made it out of like You know, those sort of like brown bread crates and like some old tins I'd found and some like bits of scrap wood. And it was really funny. And like, you know, I was doing this sort of selling this future manual from outside this thing. And someone came up to me and asked me if it was a God thing. And because obviously I've got all these signs saying like worried about tomorrow, start preparing today, all this sort of stuff.
Wow. Because it is also that fanatical. I think it's also the God thing because it ends up being fanatical. That's interesting.
Completely. You know, there's loads of really fanatical is a good word. Loads of really sort of scared people and really mad people who are, and fall into this trap of sort of doom and gloom.
Yeah.
And I didn't really want to go down that path.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I suddenly realised that, like, you know, conceiving of this thing as publishing and as writing wasn't getting me anywhere. And suddenly, instead, conceiving of it as art and doing it in art spaces and asking art, you know, I phone up a gallery or email a gallery and say, can I do this with you? And I ended up doing this national tour of rabbit catching fire starting workshops. Mm. And art gallery's like, yeah, fine, great. It's art. And I suddenly, that, you know, all the stuff I'd done previously of like creating this work, creating these publications, and finding ways to distribute them and doing projects, suddenly I realized that I could conceive of that that way. And also, and I think the really interesting thing, for me, the publishing world is sewn up, you know, like you either do your book or you make your poetry books or you do your poetry pamphlets or your poetry zines or whatever. And there's only really a few ways you can operate in that world. Or you get a job writing for Vice or you get a job writing for Guardian, you know.
Yeah.
Whereas the art world is a lot more open and there are people within it. And, you know, I still know very little about the art world and I still, I'm sure, don't appeal to a lot of curators or whatever. But there are curators and there are people and there are audiences who are interested in this way of thinking. Mm. And suddenly you can in this sort of space too.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I mean, it's interesting to think about that as a reframing device for yourself as much as anything else, because you've mentioned the word hippie a few times before that. And I was interested in this idea of like trying to find where you fit, I suppose. It sounds like that's sort of what you were doing. I mean, as much as in terms of sustainability, as much as anything else, like how to keep yourself going, right?
Yeah. Totally, that's it. How do you keep yourself going? How do you fit into this machine and how do you make it pay and all this sort of stuff? Because, you know, I am not a hippie and I've always really disliked hippies.
That's interesting.
I think it comes from that sort of, you know, I really like pop culture. I was raised on it. I was raised on the A-Team and Star Wars and Lego. And
yeah.
Like, I think it's really easy with all this sort of stuff to have your sort of little hippie your way of life that doesn't interact with that world, and to sort of say, no, I don't want anything to do with it. And I want to go and live in a big house that someone just happens to own, right? And like, you know, the lack of reality in the hippie world and the lack of not admitting that actually you need money to be a hippie, you need to be quite well off to live in this alternative way.
Well, I think that's really interesting as well in terms of the practicalities of I think really literally like imagistically and in terms of words, but that idea of being like going to ground or being grounded feels very relevant because you're often like in the ground, you're building things from the ground up, you're spending time in outside spaces, so the idea of being grounded in all senses feels relevant.
Yeah, that's interesting
in that piece sense as well, you know, it's not floaty in a sense.
Exactly. I just think it's really important with all of this stuff to do something that normal people, because I consider myself a normal person, right? And like, obviously that's got a lot of connotations to it, but but that normal people can grasp and get involved in and doesn't just that appeals to people who aren't just the people who go to art galleries,
yeah,
and aren't just people who studied art at university and aren't just people who are architects. And of course you only get to be an architect because your parents were an architect. Like, you know, like I think that you have, cause if you want to actually have an impact on how people live and how they understand the world, then I think you have to do something that is accessible to those people and not just couched in art speak and not just, you know, my, like, and the number of times I go into a gallery, and I think that this is the thing for me as well, like, as a non-artist, as a sort of coming to someone who was outside the art world, to go into a gallery and see something on the walls that says, like, something like, my work takes its starting point, Joseph Beuys, 1930, and you're just like, what the fuck are you all talking about? Like, why do I have to have this, pass this test to understand what it is you're saying?
Yeah.
And that's always struck with me, and, you know, and just as a sort of like aside, I think that's why I like East Side Projects in Birmingham so much, because they've got that. It's not intellectual. It's not esoteric, but nor is it the other end of the spectrum. It's not like Sheffield galleries where everyone's like, "Hey, up, you know, press this. Come on, come and press a button." It's challenging, but it's something that that people can access, that people can understand, that people can be moved by or angered by or respond to. I think that's really important.
It makes me think a lot about collaboration though too, because the number of people I've heard speak about East Side Projects, that it's about being, they want to be involved. And it's interesting, even myself thinking, I want to be part of that thing. Like, I want to, you know, be part of that conversation and be, and a lot of the people who've been on this podcast actually have shown there, and they've all said that they've often approached that gallery. It's not the other way around, you know. That's quite an interesting concept, that actually these shows are as much about collaboration as about, like, you know, funding an artist to make a work, or like realizing a big project, or it's actually about something about bottom up, top down, or something. I just wonder if you could talk a bit about, I mean, I love the way you've talked about disrupting the system and certainly remaining critical of it, which I think is a fascinating, like, voice to have within the art world, and a really important one. But in terms of collaboration, you've mentioned, like, in every project there's almost always some other people, if not just one other person, but who you're working with. And we might talk about some of the specific projects, like The Clearing, but what collaboration means, why it's important, and not just in terms of with the audience, but with these other people you're working with.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think, like, for a start, it's often based on stuff that I can't do. And so I think that, you know, if I want to teach people how to make a, like, I learned how to build fires on my own, and I learned how to start fires with flint and steel and, you know, all those sort of old-fashioned methods. Also futuristic methods, and I learned how to catch rabbits, but there's so many things that I don't know. And so, for instance, The Clearing was I think the best project I've ever done, and the best work I've ever made, really. And it was just really, it's this so wonderful and such an exciting project, and that was a big part of that was from collaborating with Alex Hartley on it. And that came about because, you know, this sort of the journey I've been on in terms of, like, working out how to talk about climate change really started when I was looking into the door of his dome. So he built these amazing geodesic domes, and I went to this, I just heard about it. So the show was called The World Is Still Big. And basically he built all these amazing, massive photos, like sort of, you know, A0, A1, huge canvases of photos, and then of these really abandoned environments. And then built out of them with sort of modelling clay these structures, these abandoned human structures. And it was just like the saddest, most desolate landscapes you can imagine, like all these sort of abandoned human structures, basically. And like half utopian and half dystopian. And then outside the gallery, it was a Victoria Miro, which is the gallery that he is represented by. And outside, they got this canal. And on the other side of the canal, on the other bank, he built one of these geodesic domes. And basically, I was just sort of stood there in, I think it was January 2012, like a long time ago, and just stood there looking into the door of this dome. And on the one hand, it was this sort of rusty and knackered and, you know, pretty dystopian structure that looked like it was existing in after some sort of collapse. But then on the other hand, you looked inside it, and there were all these blankets, and there were some really nice welly boots and some nice books lined up, and there were chickens living next to the dome. On this little platform, on this canal. And there was something really soft and warm and human and gentle about it too. And that has been this sort of really guiding thing, like that contrast between this, you know, being quite a scary thing, but also the potential to be quite a soft and warm and gentle thing. And so anyway, my mind was completely blown away by that and by his time and his vision of this future. Mm. And so after I've done all these future manuals and after I realized that I wanted to help real people learn how to make, to do real skills and make actually useful things.
Yeah.
I realized that the next step was to actually create a place where people could come to do that. And a physical place where people could feel what the future might feel like. And I think that's really interesting because a big problem I think we have is that you read about it in The Guardian or you read about it in the New York Times or even on, you watch it on BBC4 and then the next programme or the next article is about tennis or it's about, golf or watches or economies or airlines needing bailouts or all this sort of stuff.
Mm.
And actually it's really impossible, it's very, very, very difficult from within our world to think about what this next world might be like and how it might feel to be in that world. So I really wanted to create a place where people could actually feel it for themselves. Mm. And I asked Alex if he'd like to collaborate, because of course, as much as I can do these workshops and create this narrative, I can't build. I don't really know how to build anything. Mm. And so I asked him if he wanted to collaborate with me on it, and he was really generous because he is an established artist. He represented Britain at the Olympics, a sort of cultural Olympiad, and he created this amazing project called Nowhere Island. He's made it.
Yeah.
He didn't have to collaborate with me, but he said, "Yeah, of course, why not?" And that is, throughout, he's just so generous and so open and. It was just really brilliant working with him. So I think that was the, in terms of collaboration, just getting to act to benefit from other people's skills.
Yeah.
But also to share what you're doing and to have someone else to talk to about it. Because I think that is, a really key thing.
Definitely. I mean, it's something that I continually try and remind myself as a painter that, collaboration is what it's about. That's it. That's the only way we can sustain ourselves in any form, I think. But I think there's a word that came out of the clearing project which stuck with me, the caretaker, and this idea that people were invited to be caretakers of that space. So thinking, I guess, about how we look after things, how we look after ourselves, but also each other and spaces and animals and the environment. But also something about how we take responsibility for the space we have too. So thinking about where we live and how we live. So maybe you could talk about the caretaker role and how that evolved and who were caretakers for that project.
Yeah. So basically the project, The Clearing, was this vision of the future in the grounds of Compton Burnie Art Gallery. And we wanted to build this physical place where people could learn how to live in the collapsing world that's coming our way. And so it sort of had these three elements to it. There was the dome itself, which we built with out of scrap materials with volunteers in the middle of the actual clearing on the banks of the Galleries Lake. And then there were these 20 or so workshops that taught you all the skills you'll need to live in this imaginary future when Big Sainsbury's is on fire and the global economy has collapsed.
Yeah.
I talk about Big Sainsbury's all the time because I just think it's hilarious.
I was about to say that because that was in Bread and Jam. Like, there's a sign that says, "Are you worried about what happens when the Big Sainsbury's burns down?" And that this feels like a motif or a rhetorical question, which is like fundamental for you.
I just think it's so interesting that we have, it's going back to that Barrett House childhood. Like,
yeah,
that, from that moment on, we have let ourselves be totally denuded of any agency and any. Control over how we live, and so we have not the first clue where the stuff that lines the shelves of Big Sainsbury's comes from, or how it gets there, or who's growing it, or where it's how it's grown. We have a sort of vague idea that it's grown in Spain in a desert somewhere, but we have no idea what that actually looks like.
Yeah, totally.
And then it goes through to everything. Like, we have no idea what an espresso machine is made of. We have no idea how to fix it. We are, yeah. It's impossible to fix your own iPhone. Like, you have to really, really work at it to try and fix it.
Yeah.
And I just think I watch the Teletubbies a lot with my daughter. she's going out of it now a bit, but just that sort of Teletubby world where everything is done for you and you're just sort of it's so passive and such a consumer of that world. And you the work that you do, the work that we all have in this country is so pointless compared to the actual stuff that we use and buy. You know, it's so disconnected from that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, which is also interesting thinking, sorry, I'm jumping all over the place, but it's also interesting thinking about that in terms of like the work being pointless, because now a lot of people haven't been able to work this in this pandemic moment, I guess. We're all, that idea of like who we are, our sense of self, our sense of what's the right word, a sense of satisfaction and feeling good about what we're doing in the world has been taken away completely, because work is like where it was all at, right? That idea of being busy was like a state of addiction or something. And then how many people are then turning to gardening and stuff and growing things, even on little window boxes, or I just think there's something in that, you know, this idea of where our sense of purpose, that's what I'm talking, I guess I mean.
Purpose, that's exactly it. I remember very vividly reading this thing in The Road to Wigan Pier by Orwell, where he talks about how, I can't remember the exact quote, but it's about how, you know, like, it shouldn't be about, like, socialism shouldn't be about making everyone's life sort of, like, quicker and easier and faster and just, yeah, like, you know, like, my mum often talks about, like, it's just easier. Like, why do you cook scrambled eggs in the microwave? It's just easier. Why do you have a fake fire rather than a real fire? It's just easier. And actually, I'm really interested in, you know, like, the Orwell quote is something about how, you know, life should be about being simple and sort of slower and simpler and, you know, not harder, but more real. I can't really get to the bottom of it, but I'm not interested in a life that's easier. I really enjoyed watching Wall-E. I'm not sure if you've seen Wall-E.
No.
Because Wall-E is the, you know, the Disney film about the robot. Like,
oh, Wall-E, yes. Yeah, sorry, yeah, I say it differently. Yeah, yeah. I know what you mean.
But like it, you know, everyone in that is just, it's the logical endpoint where you basically sit in a chair and have everything done to you, and that's not living. And I think that what you were saying about how people have you know, during lockdown, they're suddenly growing things and they're cooking things and they're making things, and they have time to actually, rather than rush, you know, getting home from work at 8 o'clock and putting some food in the oven that they don't want to eat, and then telling the vision that they don't want to watch, and then scrolling through Instagram and then going to bed angry. Mm. You've actually got an alternative, which is to slow down and to live in a real way, and to make some of your own food, and to make food for your neighbours or your, you know, the people in the house with.
Do you think some of this is about like sensation? Because I keep thinking about this. It's something about like, how good does it feel to put your hands in earth, for instance? Like digging is like amazing, right? It feels phenomenal. And earth feels great. Like hands in earth feels amazing. And there's something about the sensation of, like, if we can get turned on by it, I guess, not in a sexual way, but in a way that's about like a haptic experience, like the sense of touch being a stimulus, like enjoying food is an obvious one, right? But something about, because gardening is not very like trendy even, like the idea of gardening is like, I don't know, I'm just interested in the gap between why we don't do it or why we don't value it, and then what is actually there to be valued, like making boiling water to make tea when you're camping, the tea tastes like out of this world, because you spent like time getting the water, boiling the water, watching it, hearing it, you know, smelling it, and then pouring it, and then waiting. I don't know, there's definitely something in that.
But I think it's not so much the sensation. I think that is really important, but I think it is, like you say, like it's not trendy, and I think that because it's very difficult to monetize it, right? I think that the mess we're in is, you know, and you need to be careful about using words like capitalism, because it turns people off completely.
Mm.
But I think the mess we're in is as a result of letting all of our human needs be, you know, packaged up and sold to us as a little sort of product or something on Instagram or, you know, like, so rather than sewing our, fixing our own iPhones or fixing our, you know, I really enjoy sewing up holes in clothes. It makes me feel amazing. But rather than doing that, you're sort of like, you're buying all your clothes from someone else. You're completely alienated from everything that you need in your life. And I think that is because cleaning products at home, for instance, like you're sort of, or you know, soap, or all of these things are suddenly resold to you as shower gel, resold to you as something in a sort of bright packet that's going to change your life. Yeah. And again, it's just that thing of like taking agency away from you. And because things like gardening and things like cooking for a family, it's very difficult for someone to package that. And, you know, they're trying, and capitalism has to try, and it has to, that's the logic of it. It's not someone sat in a smoky room trying to enfeeble the human race. It's just trying to make some more profit. Mm. But, you know, like my girlfriend's sister was in lockdown in Wales, and they ordered one of these sort of boxes, like we call the Mindful Chef box.
Oh, yeah.
And so they're trying to make cooking something that you have to order online, and you have to, you know, get a particular box for. But it was probably the least mindful thing I've ever received. And so you know, they're really trying to get their hands into that as well. But I think that's been the interesting thing about lockdown, is that suddenly people realise that they have time to do these things that they didn't have time to do before.
Yeah, yeah.
And then suddenly it's in this very sort of revolutionary moment where they realise that they can do them, and not only that they can do them, but that they enjoy doing them, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so suddenly, like, making your own jam or making your own bread rather than buying it from a shop is enjoyable as well as necessary. I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And I think it's important to also reference some of the things, because you're not just doing those things in these workshops that you're running. I mean, one of them was like how to build a toilet, right? So these are like, you know, you're not like doing like, they're not sort of twee, enjoyable Saturday afternoon or Sunday afternoon. They're quite serious, some of these things, which is amazing as well.
Yeah, and it's not, I think that's the thing. If you just do it as sort of craft, in a, you know, how to make your own, how to knit your own like place settings, or how to, you know, make your own greetings cards, all this sort of stuff, then it just becomes a very twee thing. But also, it's, you know, you're still obliging the people in the developing world to make your paper and your phones and your shoes and your clothes and everything that you actually need is still being made for you by people who've got much harder lives than you somewhere else on the planet.
Yeah.
Because we found gunpowder first, right? Not even gunpowder. We found the Industrial Revolution. We did the Industrial Revolution first. So we get to tell you that you have to make our clothes. And that is what it comes down to.
And it seems like a really potent message this week as well, particularly. But yeah.
Exactly that. And, you know, whereas we're, So I think that's a really important thing, that it's not just this sort of like little nice craft things that the extra things that make your life interesting that you can do yourself, but the basics. And again, I think that, you know, the sort of the toilet stuff or the mead stuff or the chicken stuff is all really important, because again, it's, you know, we were learning this from this amazing woman from the Centre for Alternative Technology in Macunliffe in Wales. And she was explaining to us that all you really need is some sawdust and a bucket. And if you get, as long as you separate the wee from the poo, you poo in the bucket, you put sawdust on the poo. Once the bucket's full, you close it for 6 months to a year. Yeah. And then all of the bad bacteria, the pathogens in the poo, is outcompeted by the bacteria in the sawdust.
Yeah.
And after a year, it's inert. And again, it's like this sort of thing that you don't have to, you know, you don't have to be scared of poo. You don't have to be scared of the you're a human being. You're alive.
Yeah. You're allowed to leak.
You're allowed to leak, man. And
yeah,
I don't know. I get very like wound up about it. And I think I think it all comes back, all comes down to hating Tesco's so much. And
yeah, it's not just Sainsbury's. It's just to make that clear. One of my, I need to draw this to a close. I feel like I've still got so much to ask you, but I guess one of my pressing questions at Seals, like, what I'm interested in this sense of the future. Like, are you planning for the future like 100 years from now? It's not like a sci-fi dystopia future. I mean, maybe it is also, but I'm interested in this question. What is, or when, maybe when is, how far is this future? Are you thinking?
That's a really interesting question. I don't, and I think that like loads of people talk about this stuff now. I think it's really important to read as much as you can about it. And there are some really good people who are basically saying that the future that we're all worried about in the West is actually how people live now in Mexico and Bangladesh. You know, and like it is unevenly distributed, as William Gibson said. And like, so, you know, on the one hand, we're in a very privileged position where we can all be sat here worrying about the end of the world when other people eat. But I don't really know. I think that something is going to happen because it's physics, you know, and unfortunately, I wish it was art. I wish it was down to culture and writing and art, but unfortunately it's down to physics, and there's now too much carbon in the atmosphere, and there's, you know, and obviously there's too much, there's too few rainforests left, and all the extinction that's happening, and all of these sort of interconnected crises. So something will happen to us and to the way we live. But I think that I'm not actually that prepared for it. I don't live in a dome. I live in Northwest London.
I think that's a key point too, that in all this, and every time I've met you, from Bread and Jam till, you know, till now, I guess, and all my thinking about you in between, you're not judgmental, you're not closing anything down. You want to think about this in a reality way.
Good. I'm glad you think that, because I think that's the key thing. Like, you know, if you, I remember starting the Future Manual and explaining what I wanted to do to my friend, and he said, if it was just about me surviving on my own, then he's not interested. And I think that's the key thing. It's like, you know, you can't, all these preppers and all these survivalists going off to live in the forests with all of their canned goods. Yeah. And actually, it doesn't make sense, because once those canned goods are gone, what are you going to eat then, guys? You know. But just the idea of sort of surviving on your own is totally flawed. And actually what you need is people, and you need to survive with them. So I would like to, you know, try and find some land where I could live that isn't surrounded by lots and lots of other people, because where I live in Kilburn is so dense, and you realise that you can only live like that because of the systems that we have in place, right? Because of the amount of food that comes into the supermarket every day, and the amount of water and the amount of gas and all these things that we need. So it doesn't feel that sustainable the way I'm currently living. But equally, I don't really know the answer to that question. I do feel like I need to get a bit more prepared. And this pandemic and the sort of the fear that was around about 2 months ago when people were panic buying has made me feel like I need to live a bit more off-grid in some way, a bit more sufficient in some way, you know. I don't really know how to do that yet. So we shall see.
Yeah, amazing. Well, maybe something to do with the absolute beginners, because I feel like that, to go full circle, that idea of making things, young people, like looking to the next generation and what they can make and equipping them with skills is also really hopeful. So
totally right. And like, you know, I'm not expecting that these young people can come out of this factory and set up a business making A4 paper out of locally sourced recycled paper with their hands, or making, you know, cups, or making sandals out of tires straight away. But it's more about giving them actual real skills, also like opening up this space where they can talk about, and we can talk about, how it feels to make things, and how we're consuming at the moment, and how it might feel if IKEA, you know, the shelves of IKEA were no longer magically filled every day, and we'll have to do it on our own. And I think that's it for me. It's like, on the one hand, trying to learn useful things now, but on the other hand, trying to create a space where people can talk about how it feels and what's going to happen.
Yeah, that's gorgeous. I think opening a real space where people can talk about how it feels to make things is like, oof, that's like the little thing to cling on to. So that's really amazing. Right, I'm going to end by asking you, thank you first. Thanks so much. And there's so much there, and we'll reference your website, which has a lot of these, the things we've touched on. We did scoot over things, and I really encourage people to look at Tom's website, which is full of all these resources, and including the Future Manual. Can people still order that if anyone wants?
No, they can't, because it's sold out. But,
I love that.
One thing we did with the clearing was we made our own book about the clearing, and we've actually put it online as a PDF, which is sort of anti the vibe of the clearing, but actually quite useful, hopefully, to people. So there is now. If you go through my website, which is tom-james.info, and go into the clearing website, there's now, like, you can read that online. So I think that's, you know, that's probably the best thing to direct people towards.
Brilliant. Amazing. And I always end by asking two questions. So the first one is, can you suggest anything that has been helpful or useful to you during this period of kind of lockdown, but also maybe coming out of lockdown?
useful to me. I think
or
that
helpful is maybe a better.
I think that, you know, the really amazing thing has been having three meals every day with my immediate family, you know, and like, as much as that has been stressful at times, it's also just been wonderful to spend, to be alive with them. And I think that sort of eating together and sharing food and, you know, just going slower and making time to do that is antithetical to us all, and particularly me, and particularly you, I'm sure, and, you know, the art world is not immune from those sort of pressures.
No, definitely. That's gorgeous, yeah.
Making time for the people that you love, which sounds really trite, but, you know.
No, it doesn't. That's so, I think love is definitely under-talked about. How things feel and thinking about love is, like, definitely two things we need to focus on. And then the last question is just anything or something that you've learned about yourself.
To be honest, I don't really know how to answer that question, but I think that something that I have learned is how beautiful London could be. And like, I think that, you know, I moved here about 5 years ago from the north, from these very beautiful places. And London is interesting and fast and exciting. And the building, there actually is some architecture here, which is a nice change from Sheffield. But it's important to say, because they've demolished it all in Sheffield. It used to have some, but it's been taken away. But I always thought it was disgusting, right? And like, the pollution is outrageous, and the way people drive is outrageous, and the speed of the city is disgusting. And suddenly to stand outside, even your front door, not just your back door, but your front door, and smell this air, and smell this sort of, the, you know, in April when all the cherry blossom was there, and it just smelled beautiful. It smelled like the whole city was a garden. There were people walking down the roads and running down the roads and cycling down the roads, and children cycling in the streets. And to suddenly realize that all along this was what was underneath the stressed delivery drivers and the men in the Audis and the BMWs speeding down the streets, you know, and there's massive long lines of cars with only one person in them. All along, that was there underneath it all. I think that's been a total revelation, like this sort of revolutionary thing that London is actually beautiful. If you could just get rid of work and capitalism.
Yeah. Oh, I love that image though. I think you're still a writer. That, like, it sounded like that was, I would read that story. It sounds like a story in there. But anyway, thank you so much. That was really insightful and exciting. And I can't wait to hear more about what happens with the Absolute Beginners Project. And if I can help in any way, I'm keen.
Okay. Thank you ever so much, Emma. It's been really nice to talk to you, and I really appreciate your time as well.
Oh, thanks, Tom. All right. Take care.
Yes. Bye-bye.
Cheers.